Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health, where we highlight the groundbreaking work that's being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me today is breast surgical oncologist Dr. Simone Mays. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Joel. Thanks
welcome
for
back.
Having me.
Welcome back. We spoke, over a year ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were about to start at JFK and at Hackensack, right?
Yes.
And now you're there.
Absolutely.
How's the how's the first year going?
It's going well. It's been quite busy, but it's definitely been well. It's been a good transition, and it's been very refreshing to be back home. As I mentioned. During our previous conversation, I had been working in Brooklyn, but I'm a Jersey girl, grew up in this area, so it's been nice to be back home and, you know, connecting with patients and finding different connections with people, and I know this person and you know that person, so that's been a beautiful thing.
That's great. So welcome home. I'm glad it's going well, and it's great to have you here. And it's good timing, too, because it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, as you, I'm sure you know. Why do we need to have a special month for it? People obviously know, and I'm half kidding here, because they don't, and we do need to continually create awareness for it.
Yeah. I think it's important to have these moments every year to kind of highlight and bring forth to people's attention because, you know, we're all busy. We have things going on. There's so many things happening such at a rapid pace that, you know, you would think that, you know, something like breast cancer, which is very common amongst women, that, you know, the majority of us are aware of what our risks are. But, you know, I talk to patients every day. And, you know, I have these conversations, and there are lots of people that are unaware of what the risks are.
Right.
And what they should be doing about them.
Yeah, it's important to keep an eye, you know, self-test and the mammograms and everything, very important. And we're going to create a much more awareness during this month, but it's, you know, obviously it should be throughout the year. You talked about the risks, you know, the breast cancer risk. What are some of the assessment tools that you use to identify women who are at a high risk for breast cancer?
Right. So for risk assessment, for a long time, the GALE model had been utilized, but I would say within the last several years, the Tyrer-Cuzick risk assessment tool has been more widely used, so much so that, patients might notice when they go for their screening mammograms now, particularly in New Jersey. I can't speak to, you know, other states, but I know in New Jersey there has been a transition to where imaging centers who do mammography will do the Tyrer-Cuzick risk assessment as part of their screening mammography. So they'll ask patients very specific questions, input that into the Tyrer-Cuzick risk calculator, and come up with a number. And that information is provided to the patient as standard as when you go for your mammogram and you receive a letter in the mail saying whatever the results are, making you aware of it. So the Tyrer-Cuzick is certainly now being more widely utilized. And the reason for that is because the Tyrer-Cuzick risk calculator incorporates a few more elements with respect to, in comparison to the GALE model. And specifically, just to kind of run down quickly what those particular elements are that are incorporated into the Tyrer-Cuzick.
Okay.
So one is certainly your age, the age of the patient. Height and weight. So one of the risk factors we may discuss a little bit further in the conversation is obesity. So height and weight are incorporated into the risk calculator. Your breast density on mammography. So when women get their screening mammogram as part of their an evaluation, as well as part of their reporting that they receive, the information that they get after they've had their mammogram, by law, imaging centers are required to make women aware of what their breast density is. And so breast density is incorporated into the risk calculator. Also things like when a woman had their first menstrual period, if they've gone through menopause, how old they were when they went through menopause, whether or not they've received any hormone replacement therapy, and for over what period of time. If they have children, how old they were when they had their first child, as well as certainly family history and any personal history of previous biopsies, and importantly, any biopsies that have demonstrated any atypical changes within the breast tissue. And with a family history component, that's a good kind of comparison between the Gale model versus the Tarr-Cuzick. The Gale model primarily only looked at first-degree relatives, so, you know, your mother, sister, or child, depending on, you know, how old you are.
Sure, yeah.
But with the Tarr-Cuzick, it not only takes into consideration first-degree relatives, but it also takes into consideration aunts, and aunts on both sides, so paternal and maternal aunts, grandparents. So it's a little bit more robust as far as the number of elements that are included to have a more kind of quote-unquote accurate assessment of the of, you know, a woman's lifetime risk for breast cancer. I know I just said a whole lot.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of factors to put together. So who would be, I want to get into, like, who would be the highest risk? Like, there's so many factors. So you could take somebody who is this weight with this breast density, with this mother has done this and the aunt did that. And there's so many different factors that each one is like a point. And I'm sure this isn't how it's done, but each one's a point. And then the higher you score is, you know, the more of a risk you are. Is that how it works?
You're on the right track. Certainly it's not that cut and dry. You know, how they do. They make these things very complex and complicated, but every element doesn't have the same weight. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
So, for example, having a grandmother who had breast cancer has less weight than having a sister or a mother who had breast cancer. And even in the family history, they put you input the age of the person, if it's known. Unfortunately, a lot of times, this information isn't clear to patients, but if they do know that, you know, for instance, their mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at 40, that certainly has more weight than your mother having breast cancer at the age of 70, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even the breast density, in my opinion, and many breast surgeons' opinion, I think the impact of the breast density can be a little bit heavier weighted than may be necessary. Because you can look, you can play around with the calculator, and you can, you know, show a patient as well, if your breast density is type D, which is extremely dense, versus, you know, type B, which is scattered densities throughout the breast, it can have a pretty dramatic change in the lifetime risk calculation. So there are some limitations to it, but I think overall it's still a very good tool as a benchmark to at least identify patients who are potentially at high risk, and that way they can have, you know, a formal, you know, consultation with a breast specialist to kind of go over a little more in detail a lot of these nuances and give them proper guidance as to what they can or should be doing to help, one, mitigate some of their risk, and also counsel them about how they should be going about their screening, because, you know, we do often screen patients who are at high risk a little bit differently than average breast women.
So what are some of the things that someone could do if they're screened, you know, they're high risk, but they haven't been diagnosed, make themselves less of a risk?
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly there's things that, you know, we can't change. Certainly we can't change our family history. But the weight aspect is a big thing, and I think oftentimes we don't, as clinicians, and I'll be quite, you know, frank and honest, we don't spend enough time delving into that particular aspect, because it's very challenging and it takes a lot of time and it's very individualized. But one of the things that I always encourage patients when I see them is to be aware that, you know, all of us, myself included, I'll raise my hand, can do better in, you know, our choices as what we eat, how much we eat, our exercise routine, whether or not we even engage and regular routine exercise. So I always like to focus on things patients have control over, so we can control to a certain extent, what we eat. We can control whether we, get up and go for a walk or, pick up some hand weights and do, 15, 20 minutes of exercise routinely, every week. So those are things that can certainly reduce your risk of developing breast cancer. And also for women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, there have been several studies that have shown women who are obese are at higher risk of recurrence. So those are, some of the things that I try to get patients to focus on so they can at least, because one of the things, particularly for breast cancer patients, is they kind of lose a sense of control over their lives, particularly when they're going through treatment, because they're just kind of having to do what is being recommended to them in their minds. And so once they're beyond that, I try to, get them to focus on things that they can control. And so one of those is routine physical activity. Strength training is very important for women, particularly as we get older. And that helps not only to promote, physical health, but also emotional. People who exercise, we release endorphins. Our moods are better. Mm-hmm. It just has an overall impact, and it just certainly doesn't impact your breast health. It impacts your overall health. So that's one of the things. Depending on the risk factor. So for high risk patients, some patients who have had previous biopsies that have not been cancer, but have been what we call atypia or atypical ductal hyperplasia is the formal term. And so that particular change in the breast does indicate that women are at higher risk of developing breast cancer in the future. And so one of the things that we discuss as an option is taking a medication to reduce their risk of developing breast cancer. And so that's specific to those specific patients. Like, we don't do that for patients who, because of family history or breast density and all these other elements, recommend direct medication. But specifically, tamoxifen has been the most, widely studied medication used for patients with atypia on a previous, breast biopsy. And so that's also an option as far as reducing their risk.
But nothing's guaranteed, right? You mentioned, exercise and working out, but there are people who are in excellent shape still getting breast cancer.
Yes, yes. So certainly, I always am upfront, and even when we're talking about treatment options and plans, nothing is guaranteed. Nothing is 100% as far as effectiveness. But having said that, I think it's always important to keep in mind, it's all about probabilities with life. Right. And so focusing on the things that can give us the lowest possible probability doesn't mean that it completely eliminates the possibility, but certainly it lowers the probability. And then on top of that, we have screening. So screening is important because even though I'm doing all these things, I eat well, I exercise, I stress, a lot of people can be very fit and eat well, but they are very stressed, whether it's, at home, at work, all of the above, just living in society with all the things that are happening. Stress is also one of those things that's hard to really nail down, and quantify.
It's a real thing, and it affects all types of health issues.
Yes. So, those are things that I always just, try to focus on. And then, marry that with, making sure you're doing your regular checks and your screenings and staying on top of that. And I think in general, if you do all those things, does it completely eliminate the possibility of you getting cancer? No. Does it drastically reduce the risk of you potentially dying from cancer? Yes, because we know that when we do pick up these things early in the process and intervene, that people have very great outcomes and live, their full life and not, have to, you know, most often not have to even deal with having cancer again. So I think that's the big picture. I always try to, you know, encourage patients to keep in mind the big picture, because it's very hard to get overwhelmed with all the different pieces and nuances. And, well, if I can do this, I can't do that.
Right.
It's always about keeping the big picture in mind.
So when someone comes into your office for the checkup or for the mammogram, what is, you know, best case scenario?
Mm-hmm.
Like how does that go down for someone who has no idea what happens in there?
Right. So most often, because I'm a breast specialist, like I typically won't see patients routinely who've had, you know, a screening mammogram. You know, they don't see anything of concern and they're told, you know, you're good to go. You can follow up in another year. So I don't often see patients in that particular situation, but I do often see patients who have these little nodules in the breast or little mm-hmm. calcifications in the breast that they don't look suspicious, but, you know, we want to keep a close eye on it. So rather than having you come back in a year, we would like you to come back in 6 months. And so I see a lot of patients with that. And so I appreciate your question, because it's important to kind of clarify that, because unfortunately, just kind of how the system is set up, you know, whether it's the radiologist or the primary doctor who is, you know, sending patients for their mammograms, you know, they don't have the bandwidth to sit down and have that conversation and explain, you know, what the actual finding is, why we're recommending you come back in 6 months rather than a year. So I appreciate you asking that question. But to kind of make it simple, there are specific criteria that a finding needs to have in order for it to be suspicious.
Okay.
And when we say suspicious, we're talking about malignancy, suspicious for cancer. And so if it doesn't meet those specific criteria, but it also doesn't check off all the boxes of being, you know, benign or not cancerous, then it falls into what we call this BI-RADS 3 category, which just, and unfortunately the description written on the report that patients get sent in the mail says probably benign, which personally, I wouldn't have chosen that verbiage.
Right.
But I don't make those decisions.
Yeah.
It just doesn't communicate a sense of security and reassurance. It says, it sounds like you don't know what you're talking about. That's me speaking.
Uh-huh.
So let me just
Well, I mean, you don't know for sure, so you can't say benign, right?
Or correct.
You have to say something before benign. What could
correct.
You say? I mean, it's like, if you explain that to a patient, listen, the reason it says probably is because nothing's guaranteed. Is that how that you go about it?
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of putting it in layman's terms. And just saying, you know, it's not suspicious. Don't worry. Don't freak out.
Mm-hmm.
But because it doesn't check all the boxes for being benign, although, you know, 95% of the time, they're completely benign. We just want you to come back in 6 months just to keep an eyeball on it, just to make sure nothing is changing and all is good. But, you know, the primary care doctor typically doesn't, you know, sit down and have that conversation. Certainly the radiologist doesn't, you know, stop and have that conversation with every mm-hmm. patient that comes through the imaging center. So patients are kind of wondering, like, what does this all mean? Nobody's really explaining it to me. So I'm glad we're having, you know, at least this conversation and you know, people listening and now in the future.
So it goes from they get
mm-hmm.
the mammogram. And then after that, really not a lot is discussed there, because it's basically they're getting an X-ray, and then they get something in the mail with mm-hmm. probably benign, and that's the mm-hmm. next. Okay. And then they see probably benign, and they're like, well, probably, what is this? And what do they do then? Who do they would call you then? And then you would say, well,
they usually what happens, they'll call their primary. Their primary is like, oh, I don't really know how to explain it to you.
Well, that's not reassuring. That's not very reassuring. I really don't know how to explain it to you. That could be scary, right? I mean, we want to try to avoid, you know, we talk about stress,
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Certainly. And let me be fair. That's mm-hmm. certainly not all primary care providers. You know,
right.
there are plenty of providers who will say, you know, hey, look, it's nothing suspicious. You know, it's just a precaution. They just want to, you know, follow up with you in 6 months rather than a year. So it's not like, you know, every BI-RADS 3 patient gets sent to a breast specialist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes, you know, you'll have a primary care provider. I think one of the important things about particularly taking these times to kind of highlight these and have these conversations is to make more people aware of what that all means. That way they're not leaving, you know, freaking out and like unsure and stressed because they're not sure what's happening and why they need to keep, you know, coming back. So I think that's the value in having these kinds of conversations.
Some people will have breast surgery when they don't have anything because of the risk or the family mm-hmm. history, right?
Well, it depends on the findings, right? So going back to the atypical ductal hyperplasia that we were talking about, that is what we call a high-risk marker or high-risk lesion. So currently, you know, standard practice, when we see that particular finding on a needle biopsy, which is usually the first step after having an abnormal mammogram that's suspicious, is the patient would be referred to have a biopsy done. And so if you find that on a biopsy, atypical ductal hyperplasia, then the standard recommendation is for patients to undergo an excisional biopsy, which is a surgical biopsy, where we go in surgically and just remove that little area of breast tissue where the biopsy was performed. And that's for two reasons. One is to remove any additional atypical cells that may be there,
mm-hmm.
because atypical ductal hyperplasia is not only a marker for risk, but it's also considered what we call a precancerous lesion. So it doesn't have the changes that are consistent with being cancerous, but if it remains, there is potential for those cells to continue to change and ultimately develop into cancer. And so that's one of the reasons why the surgery is recommended. It's also recommended because, keep in mind, a needle biopsy is just a small little needle that's taking a little bite of tissue.
Right.
So it's a sampling. During excision, roughly around 20 to 30% of the time, we actually find cancer cells in that area of breast tissue where the atypia was seen on the biopsy. So that's the other reason that surgery is recommended. Although they don't have cancer, we're recommending surgery to, one, remove any additional areas of atypia that have the potential to develop into cancer, and two, to make sure that there's not any already existing cancer cells in that area of breast tissue. So that's one example of where patients have a benign biopsy, but it has those abnormal or atypical findings that require surgery.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're out of time. I don't. Is there something else you wanted to add to that?
Wow,
I know. That's what I'm thinking. I looked up. I'm like, wait a second. We got to go. No, is there something you wanted to add to that?
No,
because I don't want to leave anything out. This is, you know, obviously too important to do so.
I was done with that particular aspect. You know, there's so many other situations where surgery may be required, even though it's not cancerous. But I think that the take-home message is to, one, be aware that there are risk calculators out there. If your primary care provider isn't aware, then you can always, you know, ask them to give you a reference for a breast specialist. If you think that you may be at high risk, depending on, you know, your family history and some of the other factors that we just mentioned. And two, just, you know, again, trying to foster a life of health, wellness, and that is multifaceted, and get your screenings.
Awesome. Dr. Simone Mays, breast surgical oncologist, thank you again. It was great speaking with you again.
Thank you.
For more info, go to jfkmc.org. And for a podcast of this broadcast, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and we'll talk again next week.